With Texas reporting new record high numbers of coronavirus cases, a warning from Washington that more needs to be done. That story coming up today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. As the fight against COVID continues, setbacks reported in the war against human trafficking in Texas. Also, high hopes versus realistic expectations with change at the White House. What Texas immigrant rights advocates think they'll see when it comes to changes on the ground. Rarely has a nation been so well served by a people so ill-treated. Now the Postal Service set to celebrate the Japanese American soldiers who saved thousands of Texans in World War II. Those stories and much more when the Texas Standard gets underway. Right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on the second day of December 2020. I'm David Brown. The UK has become the first country to approve Pfizer's COVID-19 vaccine. This, mind you, is the same vaccine that Texas Governor Greg Abbott said over the weekend was just days away from being distributed in the Lone Star State. The New York Times reports this morning that Britain has beat both the U.S. and the EU to emergency authorization, becoming the first Western nation to greenlight a COVID vaccine for mass distribution to fight a disease that has killed 1.4 million people worldwide and is blamed for the deaths of more than 21,000 Texans, according to the most recent statewide numbers. The Texas Tribune reports today that, quote, coronavirus is ablaze in West Texas as tourists flock to Big Bend and Marfa, and local hospitals are running out of options. Presidio, Brewster, and Culberson County lead the state in cases per 1,000 residents. As new case numbers soar statewide, the White House appears to be calling on Texas officials to do more to stem the spread. So reports Madeline Meckelberg for the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, welcome back to the Standard.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
Why is the White House calling on Texas to intensify its response to the coronavirus, and what are they suggesting?
So this came from a report from the White House Coronavirus Task Force. And they said, given the fact that Texas has seen an increase in new cases, stability in test positivity at a high level, and what they called an ever-rising, unsustainable increase in hospitalizations, they said the state needs to take steps right now to intensify mitigation efforts because we're experiencing a full resurgence of COVID-19.
Of course, the White House has not exactly been the gold standard when it comes to reliable information on this pandemic. I think most of our listeners have heard the stories. Why is it that this report is getting so much attention, do you think?
I think it's almost exactly what you said. The state has been setting record numbers for new daily coronavirus infections constantly since mid-November. We're clearly experiencing a surge, and I think for the most part, Texas has been in line with the White House as far as what kinds of mitigation efforts they've put in place. And so I think the fact that the White House is stepping out and saying, no, they have to intensify what they're doing there, and we're not seeing our officials clamor to respond to that, I think that's what makes this noteworthy.
Let's talk about the situation on the ground. It's my understanding that hospitalization rates, ICU units, have crossed a certain 15% threshold. This is the number of COVID cases that hospitals are dealing with, certainly in North Texas and in other parts of Texas, too. We know that we've seen huge increases in case numbers in Lubbock, in Amarillo, in El Paso, which has been widely reported. What is the governor's reaction been thus far? I mean, is he willing to return to some form of a rollback in the number of businesses that will remain open, or are we hearing anything like that from the governor's office?
So at this point, no, we're not. Abbott has said he's not going to consider anything like another shutdown, and he's not considering any additional restrictions right now. One thing that he said consistently is that he thinks local officials need to do a better job of enforcing the regulations and restrictions that are in place right now. And you mentioned that 15% threshold. That's something that his office commented to me when they spoke about this report. They said it didn't get into at all the plan that Texas has for when those hospital regions pass that 15% threshold for more than 7 consecutive days. At that point, there are additional restrictions that go into place. There's reduced capacity at restaurants. Any bars that were allowed to open have to close. So what Abbott's saying is that local officials need to do a better job of enforcing the restrictions that we have in place right now. And that's what's going to help stop this surge.
But it seems like leaders, both at the local level and at the state level, are sort of pointing fingers in opposite directions, because it's my understanding local leaders, at least in some of the state's hardest hit cities, are asking the state to scale back those reopening guidelines, right? I mean, each side is, if we're looking at sides here, sort of pointing to the other.
That's exactly right. We've seen different local officials have handled this differently and think that they know the right response for their citizens and how to stop the spread in their areas. We've seen Austin has adopted some of the more strict regulations and adopted to enforce some of the stricter regulations coming from the state. But we've seen in other areas like Midland, which is one of the areas that's seen hospitalizations exceed that 15% threshold, they voted just the other week to not enforce the statewide mask mandate that Abbott put into place, whereas Odessa just recently opted to enforce that regulation. So there's different things happening, but then other areas are saying the state isn't giving us enough leeway to adopt more regulations, and then others are saying they're asking too much of us and they need to just let us handle this how we want to handle it.
Any indication that Governor Abbott is going to acknowledge this White House recommendation? What has he had to say about it, if anything?
I've spoken with a spokeswoman for his office. He has not said anything publicly, as far as I'm aware, and she said exactly what I told you, that the report did not mention the restrictions that they do have in place relating to hospitalizations. And she told the Houston Chronicle that Abbott is relying on hospitalization data that doctors are using, and he's constantly looking at the numbers and reevaluating things. That's what we've heard from his office so far.
Madeline Meckelberg is covering this story, a state house and environmental reporter for the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, thanks so much for joining us again on The Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as we move closer to Inauguration Day, political watchdogs are looking for any clues about what we can expect from a Biden administration as far as policy goes. In Texas, that means folks are paying especially close attention to the border and what a Joe Biden presidency means for immigration. Sylvia Foster Frau spoke with immigration advocates to get a sense of what they're hoping for and what they're actually expecting. She covers immigration and border affairs for the San Antonio Express News. Sylvia, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, thank you for having me.
For this story, I gather you spoke with a number of immigration advocates about their hopes and expectations. What stood out to you the most in terms of what they're looking for once the new president takes office?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, they're very heartened by some of the pledges that the Biden administration has already taken a stance on when it comes to making a task force to reunifying children and reinstating DACA and, you know, increasing the refugee cap. But they're particularly concerned and focused on the family detention centers that are here in Texas and that were actually created during the Obama-Biden administration.
Let's zoom in on that just a bit, because I know that President-elect Biden had emphasized his ties with the Obama administration and its policies when he was running for president. How has that affected the posture of some of the folks you spoke with, especially you mentioned the detention centers that were actually used during the Obama administration?
Yeah, I think it makes them a little wary, because there's this sense that Biden is kind of going to go back to kind of the status quo of the Obama era, you know, unraveling the things that the Trump administration put in place, but perhaps simply returning to the Obama era kind of initiatives. And for them, that era was fraught with a lot of work. They were really concerned about children held in these family detention centers. There were millions of people who were deported during that time. One of them told me, you know, we want Biden to be as pro-immigrant as Trump was anti-immigrant. And based on Biden's history, you know, it's not guaranteed that he's going to necessarily move beyond the previous norm.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the key cabinet appointments he's announced, including at the Department of Homeland Security. If he's confirmed by the Senate, Alejandro Mayorkas will be the first Latino to head that department. What's the reaction been to that nomination?
Yeah, so I would say, similarly mixed, but generally positive. So, yeah, this is the first Latino, first immigrant appointed to this position. His family fled Cuba as political refugees. He was the director of USCIS, so he was really key in implementing DACA, which is something that a lot of the local immigration groups, are very happy with and are really looking forward to being reinstated. But again, he represents part of this establishment, right, that was there before. And I think that's being led with some caution. And there's also just this practicality of the fact that the Trump administration, he made over 400 immigration policy changes during his time. So like, what also can the Biden administration practically do to unroll all of those, many of those which are caught up in court, or like in the case of the border wall, there are contracts that are already signed and written off to build more miles of wall.
Yeah. In fact, let's talk about that border wall, for example. What are you hearing as far as how Biden's immigration policy proposals may affect the on-the-ground situation at the border, beefed up security presence? And of course, there's the wall, which it appears the Trump administration is racing to add additional miles to.
Yeah, so the wall, especially in recent months, it seems like that push has been accelerating to be kind of a show of what the Trump administration has been able to accomplish. Of course, it's still not all along the border, nor has it been paid for by Mexico. And, Biden's come out and said, there won't be another foot of wall built under my administration. But again, like, a lot of these contracts have already been signed. So I think it's going to be a matter of them looking into, what can we scale down? What kind of contracts or things can we just kind of axe? And what is just going to have to kind of play out as a natural legacy of the Trump administration? And he's actually only completed very few number of wall in new areas, but he has done a lot, like hundreds of miles of kind of replacement barrier that has damaged environmental and wildlife areas at the border that will have lasting impacts.
Sylvia Foster Frau is the immigration and border affairs reporter for the San Antonio Express News, and we'll have a link to her latest over at texasstandard.org. Sylvia, thanks again.
Thank you so much.
Wells Dunbar is away, but Michael Marks has been monitoring the talk of Texas on this Wednesday. Hello again, Michael.
Hey, David. Friend of the show, Madeline Meckelberg of the Austin American-Statesman, broke it down for us. The White House Coronavirus Task Force asking Texas officials to intensify their efforts to slow the spread of COVID. State posted a record number of positive cases yesterday. The truly alarming statistic, hospitalizations, those keep going up as well. Good news, as you noted, on the vaccine front, though, David. British health officials announced they've approved Pfizer's COVID vaccine. So the first doses should be administered as early as next week. When you scan through Texas social media, though, a lot of the reaction to this, frankly, includes folks who do not seem overly eager to get the vaccine themselves, or at least more than happy to let our friends across the pond jump into the pool first. Others hope it means that the rollout stateside gets sped up. I'll have those reactions when I return at the end of the show.
Yeah, we would love to hear from you, Texas. What do you make of the news about the vaccine, and how quick are you going to be to try to get the vaccine yourself? We'd love to hear from you. Just look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Michael Marks, back in 35. It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. For over a year, some 200,000 Houstonians in District B have been waiting to elect a new representative on city council. That may sound like a very local matter until you consider what's held things up. The answer to the question, can a candidate with a felony conviction run for office in Texas? With early voting finally underway, Houston Public Media's Jen Rice reports on what's on the ballot for the whole state.
The two candidates in the District B runoff got to reintroduce themselves to voters in a recent candidate forum.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
My name is Cynthia Bailey. I was born and raised in City Gas. I've been a resident of District B all my life.
Bailey runs a nonprofit for local kids, and she spent the last 2 years cleaning up illegal dumping in the district. More than a decade ago, Bailey was convicted of theft. Her opponent, Tarsha Jackson, is a longtime organizer for criminal justice reform.
I started organizing after my special needs son was arrested and jailed on the Class C misdemeanor in his special needs class.
Bailey and Jackson made the runoff last year in a crowded field. But the third place candidate sued the city of Houston and Harris County, arguing that Bailey's felony conviction disqualified her under state law. Councilmember Jerry Davis, who's term limited, has stayed on during the legal battle. In the past year, state judges have ruled three times that Bailey can be on the ballot. I asked Angianette Thibodeau, the Acres Homes Super Neighborhood president, if she hears from people in District B who are frustrated about the delay. She said,
all the time. It has gotten to the point where we're beyond frustrated. Our residents of District B are mad as hell. And they're mad because, once again, you place us on a back burner. We are a proud people, but we are very intelligent and we know what we want. The people spoke.
With neighborhoods like Acres Homes and Cashmere Gardens, the district is more than 90% Black and Hispanic. It also has the lowest median income out of all the council districts. Thibodeau agrees with many people who voted for Bailey.
I do believe in second chances. I believe in the reentry program.
And she's upset that her community was disenfranchised for a whole year because of one confusing line in state law.
If the language was ambiguous and it wasn't clear up front, then why are we holding everybody hostage and accountable now?
In fact, the question of whether people with felony convictions can run in Texas is still unsettled. Take another candidate, Willie D. He's a Houston rapper who tried to challenge Harris County Commissioner Rodney Ellis in the Democratic primary. But the local Democratic Party rejected his application because he has a felony conviction. And the party's legal counsel told me last week they'd make the same decision again today. That decision is wrong, according to State Representative Jarvis Johnson. He's a Democrat who represents the District B area at the state capitol.
I think that was a bad interpretation for Harris County, because again, my conclusion is that you can run.
He's filing a bill in the upcoming legislative session. His take, if you can vote, you can run. But for now, election rules in Texas say you cannot run if you have a felony conviction, unless you've been released from the, quote, resulting disabilities, something that's almost impossible to achieve because there's no legal definition of what that means. Lewis Conway Jr. tested the rule when he ran for Austin City Council in 2017 as a candidate with a felony. He says the state law is confusing on purpose.
The line was put there because if you don't have the legal wherewithal to understand the phrasing, it would scare you.
That's why Conway says candidates like himself and Cynthia Bailey are showing formerly incarcerated people what second chances can look like. I'm Jen Rice in Houston.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with Texans who are working safe and keeping communities strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. As we've discussed how the fight against COVID-19 has upended so many lives, we're getting news about losses in the war against human trafficking. Dallas-Fort Worth is considered a hub for human trafficking, and as KERA's Galilee Abdullah reports, advocacy groups there say the pandemic has made matters worse.
Tanya Stafford says it's been a challenging year.
I'm actually on a rescue right now. I'm sitting in the car.
She's the founder of It's Going to Be Okay. It's a Dallas-based nonprofit that helps human trafficking survivors.
I do active rescues. I house victims of human trafficking in our safe locations and give them all the necessities that they need.
Stafford's group has had to adjust to COVID-19. She says people are reaching out for help via Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. She's also noticed more people being exploited online. And as a result, her organization has had to adapt.
We have to shift all of our knowledge that we have, you know, putting in a community. We have to shift all of that to online to make sure people are still aware that human trafficking has not stopped. They're a bust on a regular basis. There are children that's being rescued on a regular basis.
While Stafford's organization works to help survivors of human trafficking, others are focused more on the demand. Caroline Roberts is a staff attorney with the advocacy group Children at Risk. She says research from a few years ago indicates that potential victims of sex trafficking are arrested at much higher rates than the buyers themselves. She wants to see more buyers apprehended instead.
Unfortunately, human trafficking is part of an economy that is just like any other economy, any other industry, and that without that demand, the industry would collapse.
Roberts says her agency's anti-trafficking efforts include using chatbots and scraping data from online sex advertisements.
One of our main programs is called Seize Texas, and that includes gathering data on the number of ads in different cities and also gathering data on responses to ads.
Roberts says when stay-at-home orders began in March in North Texas, her group noticed an initial dip in responses to sex ads. But she says they picked back up over the following months. Children at Risk has also noticed ad responses that mention financial vulnerabilities that have been caused or amplified by the pandemic.
Offering to pay bills, more and more references to being economically vulnerable, homelessness, etc. The most vulnerable segment of the population is being disproportionately affected by this virus, and that is magnified within human trafficking.
New Friends, New Life is a Dallas-based nonprofit that helps formerly trafficked women and girls. Bianca Jackson is interim CEO and says many people served by her organization are also struggling financially.
As soon as the shutdown happened, immediately within that first week, 23 of our women lost their jobs or had their hours reduced or could no longer go to work, and so the impacts on them financially was swift and severe, not to mention the trauma that's now piled on top of the trauma that they were already experiencing.
Jackson says her group will continue providing support to survivors during the pandemic.
Making sure that they had their basic needs met and remained a pillar of stability in their lives amid all of the changes that were happening.
Advocates say this stability is necessary to keep survivors out of human trafficking. Tanya Stafford with It's Going to Be Okay is herself a survivor.
I was sold at the age of 13 by my mom for drugs in South Dallas. The man that bought me kept me for 10 years. It's Going to Be Okay was truly birthed out of my story. I just began to tell people about human trafficking.
Along with showing up to rescues and providing housing, It's Going to Be Okay also provides trauma-informed care and health coverage. But the organization's ability to offer these services is dependent on funding. And the pandemic is making fundraising much more difficult.
It's a one day at a time thing. Day by day, second by second, minute by minute, we are surviving.
And she says it's important to be there for survivors of human trafficking, especially now. I'm Galilee Abdullah in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network that has been caring for Texans for more than 30 years. More than 55 physicians in the Austin area treat 26,000 cancer patients each year. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Lauren Tarrazas. Health officials in the Permian Basin are bracing for more patients in the weeks following Thanksgiving. Hospitals in the area are already strained. Russell Tippin heads Medical Center Hospital in Odessa. He described their plans during a news conference Tuesday.
We are prepping another 20, 25 beds just in anticipation of what's going to happen 10 or 15 days after Thanksgiving, just to be prepared.
COVID-19 patients exceed 15% of all hospitalizations in the trauma service area that includes Odessa. That has forced businesses to reduce capacity to comply with the governor's guidelines for reopening. Texans have until December 15th to enroll in health insurance plans through the online marketplace created by the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. The plans are for people who do not get coverage from an employer or through Medicare and Medicaid. Elena Marks heads the Episcopal Health Foundation in Houston. She says historically, 85% of Texans qualify for subsidies to help pay for the premiums.
Subsidies are offered to people whose income is between 100 and 400% of the federal poverty level.
Marks adds, as of last week, more than 400,000 Texans have already selected an ACA plan for next year. Attorneys for a Fort Worth woman convicted of voting illegally have asked the state's highest criminal court to review her case. KERA's Saida Hassan reports.
Crystal Mason had recently been released from prison when she cast a provisional ballot in the 2016 election. But Mason was on supervised release, so she was not eligible to vote in Texas. Her vote was never counted. Mason was prosecuted and convicted. Now, Mason's legal team has filed a petition with the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. Andre Segura is legal director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Texas.
We're asking that the judges of the Court of Criminal Appeals take her case, review it, and then ultimately correct what we know is a grave injustice.
In a press release from the ACLU of Texas, Mason said, quote, "I'm more energized than ever before, and I refuse to be afraid." Mason says she believed she was performing her civic duty when filling out a provisional ballot. I'm Saida Hassan in Dallas.
An information technology company is relocating its global headquarters from California to the Houston area. Governor Greg Abbott announced Hewlett-Packard Enterprise will move operations to Spring in a new state-of-the-art campus scheduled to open in early 2022. I'm Lauren Tarrazas for the Texas Standard.
You're listening to statewide news from public radio stations across Texas. This coverage is only possible because of support from listeners like you. You can help sustain and grow Texas news coverage by donating to your local public radio station today.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. The flood maps produced by FEMA are the basis for the National Flood Insurance Program. Those maps tell property owners where it is and isn't safe to build. But some developers have been able to get their flood zone designations changed with significant consequences for people who ultimately buy homes on former floodplain land and for their downstream neighbors. Alexandra Tempest has been covering this story for Fair Warning, a news site covering public health and the environment. Alexandra, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me.
In your piece for Fair Warning, you tell the story of a Houston subdivision that was in the floodplain back when the land was a golf course. But I understand developers got the property removed from the flood map and they were able to go on to build the neighborhood. Tell us more.
Sure. Well, the Springbrook Village subdivision in Northwest Houston, it was a golf course for many years. It was in the floodplain. It exists sort of south of a gully in Houston called Brick House Gully. And this area is known for flooding. Homes in this area of the city flooded during Hurricane Harvey. And this was before any sort of building happened in that area, or at the extent of building happened in that area. So it was already flood prone. And it was designated in the 100-year floodplain by FEMA. And the 100-year floodplain means that there is a 1% chance of flooding in any given year. And so because of that, developers, you know, have certain regulations they have to meet when they're building in areas that are in a floodplain. And because this area was in a 100-year floodplain, you know, the property owner at the time wanted there to be development potential, was hoping to sell this land and make it more attractive to buyers. So they hired an engineering firm that generated new flood maps and asked FEMA to, you know, get it revised out of the floodplain so that there would be more development potential for this land.
Well, I mean, on the one hand, some would say, well, you get an engineering firm, competent engineering firm, they find something different from, say, what officials have found. That's if there's a method for petitioning FEMA to change their floodplain maps, that's all on the up and up, right?
Right. Well, I think it's important to know that this process, I mean, it's, I think it is definitely was initiated as a legitimate way for property owners and, you know, developers and municipalities to question flood maps. Maybe the data wasn't very specific. Maybe a FEMA flood map didn't capture that, say, my house is on a hill. I'm not technically, even though I'm in a floodplain area, I'm protected from floods. And now, you know, but developers have reached a point where they are, I think in some cases, taking advantage of this process to get areas that they would like to develop out of the floodplain. And specifically with this piece of land in Houston, there is a residence group that has done an investigation for a number of years that alleges that this group and that this property owner and its engineering firm sort of manipulated the data to say that this area was safe from flooding when it wasn't.
And we should note here that it's not just this land that would be prone to flooding. If you change the maps, and you have construction on that property, it could affect surrounding areas as well.
Absolutely, yeah. So the idea with development in a floodplain is that often it requires, you know, FEMA will require that you elevate the homes to protect them from flooding. And that's part of the plan that a developer will submit to FEMA. And so then if the homes are elevated, they may or may not be safe from flooding, but certainly it changes the topography of the land, where then water that normally would have landed in that floodplain is going to now run off downstream to neighboring areas. Then, and there's more cement and more paved areas too, which adds to runoff as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, but what about prospective home buyers or those who have recently purchased a home? Is there any way to know whether a home you may be thinking of buying was once in a flood zone? I mean, how much transparency is there to this process?
That's actually a point of contention right now. There's a lot of talk about making sure that flood risk to specific properties is disclosed by law. There are only, I don't know the exact number of states. I think it's something like 20 some states that require flood disclosure, but not all. And so it really is, in some cases, up to the homeowner to do their research and determine if they're in a floodplain.
It's tricky business. Alexandra Tempus, staff writer for the nonprofit news site Fair Warning, has been reporting on it. We'll have a link to her latest story at texasstandard.org. Alexandra, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard. We sure do appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. In mid-November, the United States Postal Service unveiled new stamps set to be issued in the upcoming year. Among them, the first Day of the Dead stamps and also stamps celebrating Western wear. A boot, a cowboy hat, even a belt buckle with a longhorn on it. But there's another stamp coming with strong Texas ties. This stamp depicts a Japanese-American soldier in a World War II-era uniform. Texas Standard commentator W.F. Strong explains why a group of these soldiers were made honorary Texans.
We must begin our story with the 1st Battalion of the 141st Regiment, comprised of the Texas National Guard. Their nickname was the Alamo Regiment. In 1944, they were at the lead of a push to drive the Germans out of France. But they pushed ahead so fast in the Vosges Mountains that they found themselves cut off and surrounded behind enemy lines. They became known in World War II lore as the Lost Battalion. They quickly dug fighting positions in the wet, muddy soil and covered themselves with tree limbs, rocks, and dirt. They were also out of food and water. Even Hitler became aware of the Texan situation, and he issued orders that they were not to slip away. They were to be killed or captured at all costs. American forces pounded the German lines with their artillery, but the forest was so thick they weren't having much effect. So they had two different infantry battalions try to break through the German lines, and each was repelled by horrific hailstorms of bullets from the German machine guns called Hitler's buzzsaws. This is when the 442nd and 100th Infantry Combat Regiments were called in. Battle-hardened, they had a reputation for succeeding in just these situations. Their motto was, "Go for broke." It took them 5 days of brutal close-quarters combat on muddy terrain in bone-chilling weather to reach the Texans. The 442nd started out with 3,000 men and took 1,000 casualties, 800 wounded, 200 killed in action. It is said that the first soldier of the 442nd to reach them merely walked up to their commander, Lieutenant Marty Higgins, and nonchalantly pulled out his Lucky Strikes and said, "Cigarette?" Higgins gratefully accepted. After almost a week, they were freed from the German onslaught. What makes this an even more surprising story is not just the ferocity with which the 442nd fought or the casualties they took to save their brothers in arms. The real surprise is that the 442nd was a Nisei regiment, comprised of second-generation Japanese Americans. Most of them, along with their families, had been put into internment camps at the beginning of the war. These men, however, asked if they could fight rather than sit out the war. And they were extraordinary fighters. The 442nd was called the Purple Heart Regiment because they received more Purple Hearts than any other unit their size in World War II. When the 442nd returned from Europe, President Harry Truman said, "You have fought not only the enemy, but you have fought prejudice, and you have won." Many years after the war, President Bill Clinton upgraded a good number of the military awards for the 442nd. Some of the Nisei had not received their due because, sadly, they were Nisei. And that is why Governor Connally, too, paid tribute to the Nisei by making them all honorary Texans. It was his way of demonstrating to these soldiers and their descendants the solemn gratitude of the great state of Texas. I'm W.F. Strong. These are stories from Texas. Some of them are astonishingly true.
W.F. Strong is a professor of culture and communication at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. You can check out more of his stories from Texas at texasstandard.org, in Texas Co-op Magazine, and wherever fine podcasts are served. The effort to get a Nisei soldier stamp has been more than a decade in the making. Wayne Osaka led the campaign to get the stamp. Wayne, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What do you think made the Nisei regiments so effective? And apparently they were. It's my understanding that this particular unit won 7 distinguished unit citations, 21 congressional medals of honor, 5,200 Bronze Star medals, 588 Silver Star. It's phenomenal.
It really is, and it's a legacy that's very important to the Japanese American, the greater Japanese American community. The Nisei spirit came from their parents, who really taught them to really keep their goals ahead of them, no matter what obstacles they may face. And that really is what Go For Broke, the motto, embraces.
This despite the way that Japanese Americans were being treated at home.
That's correct. Yeah, they, despite the government classifying them not as citizens anymore, but as enemy aliens, if you can believe it, they wanted to prove their loyalty and still serve the United States. We would train teachers how to bring the story into their classrooms, and veterans would come along to teach. They would share, number one, about how important it was for them to show that they are full-blooded Americans, just like their classmates growing up. They also wanted to really bring pride to their family. It's also just being proud of who you are, where you came from, and doing what you believe is right.
Why was this important to you to push for this stamp?
Me personally, it really strikes me to the core. My parents were both incarcerated in the camps due to their Japanese heritage, nothing to what they did. They were just junior high kids. And I have a number of relatives, including my uncle and great uncle, served in the military during the war. Growing up, they would really just talk about the camps. They talk about camp stories. And I would be curious, what kind of camp are we talking about? And as I got older, I started to realize, oh, this is not like a summer camp. They were incarcerated for about 3 years behind barbed wire. And then they came out with the government gave $25 and a bus or train ticket and said, you know, good luck. But the Nisei generation was able to overcome all that and then still create families, create a community that I'm proud of.
I think it was President Clinton who once said that rarely has a nation been so well served by a people so ill treated. What do you want people to get out of this stamp and ultimately, and why do you think that this recognition by the Postal Service is important?
Well, the founder of the campaign, Fusa Takahashi of Sacramento, California, she said, hey, it's just a little stamp, but it has a big impact. And she really wants the younger generations to be able to see this legacy on a U.S. commemorative stamp and to know and be proud of their heritage. So she and two of her friends put this stamp campaign together that's been 15 years in the making. This is a true grassroots effort, and we've had people in Texas really rise to the challenge. And Sandra Tanamachi, who's from a family with one uncle that passed away, was killed in action during that rescue. Gary Nakamura as well. He has a father that was interned in Gila River in Arizona, yet served. And both of them are important to the effort in Texas.
Wayne Osaka is coordinator and co-chair of Stamp Our Story, which led the effort to have Japanese American soldiers recognized on a U.S. postal stamp. Wayne, thanks so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Governor Greg Abbott recently said that shutdowns are, quote, ineffective at slowing the spread of COVID-19. He also claimed that the virus is not commonly spread at workplaces. Are those the facts? Looking into claims like these, Brandon Mulder with PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Brandon, welcome back.
Thank you very much.
So what's the lowdown on this claim from the governor? Give us some background.
So about 2 weeks ago, Abbott and other state officials gathered in Lubbock. This was several days after Abbott announced that he would not be imposing a statewide shutdown despite rapidly rising case numbers across Texas. And during that press conference, he took a moment to defend that decision. Let's listen to some tape.
Lesser known, however, is the ineffectiveness of it, because one thing that we've learned over the course of COVID is one of the most common ways that COVID is spread today is not by someone going to work, but by people gathering together in home settings or in casual settings.
Let's take a look at the shutdowns that the governor has imposed in the past, which forced gyms, bars, restaurants, other businesses to close or scale back capacity. Were those effective? How do you gauge that?
Well, it's pretty difficult to gauge, actually. We don't quite know exactly how Abbott's measuring effectiveness. As we know, shutdowns have a wide variety of social and economic consequences. But experts say that if you're measuring effectiveness strictly by case numbers and transmission rates, lockdowns or shutdowns have certainly contributed to driving down those numbers. So, for instance, let's look at the last time Texas imposed a shutdown. This was back near the end of June. Uh-huh. When cases were peaking at around 5,000 new infections per day. Abbott ordered bars closed, he scaled back restaurant occupancy to 50%, and allowed local governments to place restrictions on outdoor gatherings. That shutdown order was lifted in mid-September when new reported cases dropped to about 3,500 per day. But it didn't take long until case numbers began ramping back upwards, ultimately reaching the record-breaking high of 14,600 cases we saw last week.
All right. I know that causal connections are quite frequently difficult to, firmly establish. What are healthcare officials saying about the shutdown? Do they say it was effective? What do you know about them?
Yes. So the experts we spoke with did say that the shutdowns definitely impacted, the lowering of the case numbers back then. But they also said that, as people experience shutdown fatigue, which they said is a very real thing, and as people are drawn to holiday gatherings, shutdowns become much harder to enforce and therefore a little bit less practical.
Okay. Let's move on to another part of that statement. Governor Abbott saying, we now know that COVID is not most commonly spread at workplaces. What about the truth there in that statement?
Well, it's hard to sweepingly say that workplace gatherings don't enable transmissions. Many of us, of course, are still working from home for that very reason. But while some of us have the ability to work remotely, many don't, and Abbott's comment ignores that fact. Two quick examples. One is the outbreak of cases in meatpacking plants in the Texas Panhandle, which was struck hard during the first wave of the pandemic. A second is the construction industry, which Abbott exempt from shutdown orders. A study by UT researchers found that hospitalization rates among construction workers in the Austin area rose precipitously during the first 6 months of the pandemic. But precautionary measures like masks and social distancing and hand washing stations have helped both industries ward off mass outbreaks, but proper precautions can still be difficult to achieve in many low-paying, high-contact industries.
Yeah. Let's get to the ruling. What is it?
Well, we rated this false. While shutdowns may be hard to enforce at this stage of the pandemic, they haven't proven to be completely ineffective at slowing the spread in the past. And infections have been known to break out in the workplaces of some industries more so than others.
Brandon Mulder is with PolitiFact Texas. Brandon, thanks again.
Thank you.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Michael Marks in for Wells Dunbar, monitoring social media on this Wednesday. Hello again, Michael.
Hey, David. More and more signals these days that the COVID-19 vaccine is forthcoming. The big announcement that Britain has approved Pfizer's vaccine. We hit on that at the top of the show. You asked folks to tell us their thoughts on vaccination. They have done so. In Houston, Jan K. Hive tweeted at us that, "While I have trepidation about taking the vaccine, I will roll up my sleeve. An efficacious vaccine will free me to resume my life." In Dallas, Robin Pania tweets in part that, "You better bet I'm going to get vaccinated. I admit I was initially skeptical, but science." And in El Paso, Twitter user Nay says she plans to get the vaccine, but doesn't plan to get back to normal right away. She tweets, "I think that a vaccine will be the most effective thing we could have for this pandemic. Will it end the pandemic? No, but it is the best option we will hopefully have. People need to understand that it will not just end right away." So, again, I think there's going to be some time for this to play out, right? People will be able to have more information, you know, to make their decision by observing what's happening with other people.
Yeah, I think part of the significance of Britain's authorization is they're the first nation in the West to grant emergency approval to this vaccine, and that begins mass inoculations. I think one of the questions that some people are raising is, first of all, why did Britain authorize a vaccine before the U.S.? This is a U.S. company that was, I believe, working with a German firm on this. The second question, I think, is will this turn up the pressure on the FDA to issue an emergency approval? And of course, I think the suspicion is whether there will be corners cut. We're receiving a lot of information from health experts saying, no, it's not really that corners are cut in this process. However, I think that's something that's sort of looming out there as a question in the minds of many. I just noticed, Michael, New York Times reporting the CDC is shortening the quarantine period after possible virus exposure. Apparently, people who may have had coronavirus exposure but who are asymptomatic can quarantine for 7 days instead of 14 if they test negative. That's the latest from the CDC, as reported by the New York Times just a few moments ago.
Well, it's interesting you bring up, the concerns about corners being cut. That's definitely one of the themes that you see on social media, people being concerned about that. This tweet from Stephen Flynn in Houston says, "The fact that the UK has approved Pfizer's vaccine certainly shouldn't alter our review timetable or our analytic approach." So folks are definitely concerned about this. And Mr. Flynn there in Houston saying, I really hope that our public health officials aren't unduly influenced by what's going on in the UK necessarily.
It's interesting. Dr. Stephen Hahn, Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, recognizing this and saying yesterday that the FDA is one of the few regulatory agencies in the world that actually looks at the raw data. So that may be one of the reasons why the U.S. has been a little bit slower on this approach. But this is a developing story and one that I'm certain you will continue to hear more about as the day progresses. So keep it right here. We're out of time for the big broadcast. The news continues over at Texas Standard. .org. We invite you to join us there till tomorrow.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, the George Huntington Family, and St. David's Foundation. Additionally, Texas Mutual Insurance Company is a founding sponsor of Texas Standard.